Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. Thanks, Jeff, for taking the time to speak to the sustainability agenda today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really looking forward to talking to you and focusing really on your latest book, your rather wonderful and scary The Water Will Come. And maybe we can touch on some other topics and subjects that you've written about connected to that, or I guess more generally to do with the environment and so forth, but really to focus on that book. There's a lot of material there and a lot of ideas, important work. So I guess just maybe if you could set the scene a little bit about what you do and how you came to write this book.
Well, I've been writing about, you know, energy and climate change for about 15 years, you know, covered all kinds of aspects of it, from, you know, coal mining and the coal industry to, you know, spending a lot of time with climate scientists and writing about, you know, what's going on in Greenland and Antarctica and droughts and all kinds of things. But I never really thought much about sea level rise other than as a sort of abstract and kind of distant future threat, the way that I think a lot of people think of it, until Hurricane Sandy hit New York in 2012. I wasn't in New York that when the storm hit, but I lived nearby and went into the city the next day. And, you know, I was walking around the Lower East Side and, you know, looking at all of the soggy streets and, you know, cars that were still full of water and the smell of the city. And it was really striking, of course, for obvious reasons, seeing what, you know, 9 feet of water, which was how much the storm surge that hit New York, how much water it pushed in there. And I called a friend of mine who's a climate scientist, and we were talking about it. And he said to me, you know, one way to think about this is as a kind of dress rehearsal for sea level rise. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, imagine this 9 feet of water that came into New York City, instead of going out in a few hours, imagine that it stayed there. And, you know, that's sort of what sea level rise is going to look like. And I thought that was a pretty profound idea. And then he said, if you really want to blow your mind, go have that same thought experiment in Miami. And so I did, and I went down to Miami and you know, was stunned by what I saw, what I realized was at risk. You know, I was there on during king tides, and, you know, there was several feet of water in the streets of Miami Beach, same streets where there's condos that sell for $10 million. And it just became very clear to me that this was, sea level rise was not a sort of future distant problem, but something was happening, you know, now and in real time, and that cities around the world, especially starting with Miami and New York, but, you know, going on from there, were not and are not prepared to deal with this, and that nobody is really thinking about what the implications of this are for the future. And that sort of launched my book.
Well, it's a fascinating book, Jeff, and really interesting to see how people are responding on the ground in locations at risk of rising sea levels. And I was particularly struck by the different ways in which people deal with this psychologically, particularly given the time frames over which this will all play out.
Yeah, well, you know, sea level rise is especially tricky in that sense because, you know, it is, even when you think about the sort of fast rates of sea level rise, it's still something that, you know, it's going to unfold in years and decades. And it's sort of this incremental changes that, you know, some places are seeing more quickly than others. And so it's really kind of a hard thing to process. And it's hard to bend our mind around the fact that, you know, even though we think it's this sort of slow creeping threat, you know, if you look at the history of the Earth and you look at sea level rise in the past, we know that, you know, sea level rise rises not just in this sort of long gradual slope, but with these kind of dramatic pulses. And there have been times in the past when we had like 13 feet of sea level rise in a single century. And, you know, there are signs that, you know, some of the same mechanisms that caused that that kind of sea level rise may be happening again as we heat the climate up and push harder and harder on the climate system. And, you know, 13 feet of sea level rise is would be just, you know, kind of essentially catastrophic for every coastal city in the world. And so, you know, it's a very big deal. And, the problem, as you pointed out, is that, you know, is the built infrastructure along the coastlines. The problem is we've built all these cities and all these places, you know, and with this idea that the land is one place and the sea is another place and it's never going to change. And we now know that not only is it going to change, it's going to change quite rapidly.
Yes, absolutely. And I know there are some researchers who talk about in the past, you know, that climate change has been, you know, a perennial aspect of life on the planet. But the key is that people were able to move and did move. And actually some argue that, you know, the kind of changes and movements that took place due to significant changes in climate are, you know, an important part of, I guess, humanity's evolution and so forth. But as you say, this when you're talking about cities, you're talking about this kind of infrastructure and development, and particularly, I guess, growing urbanization from forces that are unfolding in many different ways. And indeed, there are those who argue that actually, from a sustainability and ecological perspective, the cities actually are the best bet, really. So I guess there's two different things unfolding at the same time.
Right. And, you know, I mean, yes, there's obviously a lot of urbanization happening in the world. You know, people are moving into cities, cities are growing. Cities are really good news for in a lot of sort of environmental, from a lot of various environmental angles, you know. You know, the problem is for coastal cities is that, you know, they were not built with this kind of changing environment in mind. And, you know, the real problem with this whole sea level rise story, and one of the things I think that, you know, people have has captured people's sort of imaginations in this book and why it's done as well as it has, is, you know, it's not the sort of environmental factors, but it's the economic factors. It's the idea that, you know, as this awareness of sea level rise seeps in to people's consciousness and the risks that they run, even in the near term with, you know, higher tides, higher flooding and things, what that's going to do to the value of coastal real estate. And, you know, a lot of cities, New York and Miami are obvious examples, but virtually every coastal city, certainly in the West, is, you know, dependent upon property taxes for revenues. And as property taxes, as property values decline, revenues fall. And it's a really big economic problem for coastal cities figuring out how to deal with, you know, this declining value of coastal property at the same time when they're need to spend a lot of money to, you know, basically build coastal defenses to the degree that they can and do other things to you know, shore up the resistance to the rising water.
Absolutely. And something I'd like to talk about a little bit, but that idea also that nobody owns the risk in a way. It's very fragmented, and the idea that people buy properties, but then they get mortgages, but then the mortgages are, you know, I was just talking about particularly Florida, somewhere like that, that, you know, then they're commodified or they're turned securitized and then they're distributed, and, you know, and how this, you know, the risks just kind of are spread all around like that, and there's no central, doesn't there any central mechanism that, you know, that kind of looks after that? And maybe come back to that, but can you talk a little bit about the underlying science here of broadly at a very high level of what's happening? You know, I know on the one hand that you know, one of the big topics at the moment is in and you know, from a biodiversity and an environmental perspective is the you know, the glaciers and so forth and the ice sheets, and, you know, on the one hand the ice in the water is melts like a, you know, I guess like an ice cube in water, and is has less impact than ice on land. But I was wondering, can you identify a couple of key drivers of rising sea?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into rising seas, including sort of thermal expansion of the water. You know, as the water heats up, it expands. You know, mountain glaciers melting and all that. But really, all that stuff is sort of noise. The real issue is, you know, basically how fast Greenland and Antarctica are going to melt, and specifically how fast the ice sheets that are on the land will essentially slide into and fall into the water. As you pointed out, the floating sea ice that's already in the water, like we see, anyone who pays close attention to this sees, you know, these images of declining sea ice in the Arctic every year. We've been tracking that very closely. All that kind of stuff is not really important for sea level rise. What's important for sea level rise is how fast the glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica, you know, slide off the land into the water, essentially. And, you know, what's happened science-wise, to be, you know, very simple about it, is that, you know, in the last 10 years, as they've understood more and more about ice dynamics and, you know, the factors that influence the rate of melt, everything from soot on the snow, that darkens the snow, it causes it to absorb more heat and therefore melt more quickly, to the kind of friction underneath the glaciers as they slide over the land and into the sea. All these sort of feedbacks have basically suggested that, you know, that the risks are getting higher and higher. That, you know, the IPCC, you know, a decade or so ago had the sort of high-end risk at about 3 feet. Now NOAA, the top U.S. government science agency, has the high-end risk at 8 feet. And so it's more than doubled in the last decade or so. And I just will say that's largely because of more understanding of what's going on in Antarctica, especially West Antarctica. There's a lot of concern about, it's a complicated story, but the short version of it is the ocean is warming. It's getting underneath the glaciers in West Antarctica and could trigger a kind of ice cliff collapse. The large glaciers could start kind of collapsing because of warming from below quickly into the sea. And if that kind of thing starts to happen, there could be a massive, essentially, slide of these glaciers into the sea, which could have a dramatic impact on sea level rise. So, you know, what's basically happening is that we understand two things. One is that, you know, we're not getting emissions under control anywhere near as fast as we had hoped we might, you know, a decade or so ago. And so as the planet is continuing to heat up at a faster rate, we're also understanding more and more about the impacts that heat is having on Greenland and Antarctica, and the risks are rising.
Absolutely, absolutely. You mentioned the different ways of, I guess, calibrating the impact in terms of, you know, I guess, concentrated areas of concentrated population and also the economic risk factors as well. Where are, do you think, the biggest risk?
You mean what cities? What places? Well, I mean, you know, the risk for cities is directly related to, you know, essentially elevation. You know, geology has something to do with what kind of rock it's on and things like that. So, you know, it's pretty easy to pick them out. I mean, places, you know, a lot of my book is spent in Miami. Miami is, you know, hugely at risk because it's basically on a sort of a low-lying flat. It's a low-lying flat pancake, all of South Florida, and there's a whole lot of very expensive real estate, you know, right on the water, and the geology of the place is it's built on porous limestone, which means it's like Swiss cheese, and the water can go, if you tried to build seawalls, the water can go right underneath. So not only is it vulnerable, but it's difficult to protect. So Miami is one place, you know. Many coastal cities on the East Coast are at risk. Norfolk, Virginia is at risk. You know, Boston is largely at risk because of the landfill around the city. Internationally, you know, cities like Jakarta, which have problems with subsidence already, are hugely at risk. Shanghai is very much at risk because of a lot of the low-lying area around there. Obviously, cities like Venice, which have had also problems with subsidence for years, the subsidence is kind of being fixed, but by they're stopping the pumping of groundwater, but there's still huge flooding issues there and will continue to be. London, you know, because of the backing up of water up the Thames is vulnerable, although they're working on a new kind of barrier for that. So, you know, I went to Lagos for my book, Nigeria, a city that's very at risk. Bangladesh, of course, is the sort of poster child for, nations, entire kind of nations at risk. You know, 45 million people in Bangladesh live less than 3 feet or 1 meter above sea level. So those are sort of the hot spots around the world.
Absolutely. And what, it's a big question here, what can be done? What are some of the, I mean, I was intrigued to read about some of the activities in Lagos. And I mean, I know that there are these issues about, you know, the wealthier parts of the cities where they're, you know, going to build these high rise and that kind of thing, which is, you know, very worrying as well. What impressed you the most? I mean, I guess the Netherlands has a long track record of dealing with, you know, flooding in one kind or another. What impressed you the most, and did you get a sense that technology can save us, so that, you know, there are possibilities on that front?
Well, I mean, I think I'm very skeptical or suspicious, or you know, the idea that technology is going to save us is a notion that I have a lot of trouble with, because I think that there's a kind of technological optimism in our culture and our society now that tends to let us dismiss issues like this, thinking, oh, we'll figure out some kind of technological solution for this, and so we don't have to really worry about it. I think that there are lots of things that one can do for in various places to slow and to protect areas, slow the rise of water and protect areas. It's difficult to point to, one kind of fix, because every place is different. And one of the tricky things about sea level rise is that, you know, it's there's no kind of one size fits all solution. It depends on the geology of the place. It depends on what you're trying to kind of protect, things like that. So, I mean, the obvious things are, you know, in the Netherlands, they've built a lot of, you know, walls and barriers, essentially, to hold back the sea. And walls and barriers are, you know, obviously the first kind of response to most people when they think about what can be done. And those walls and barriers can be, you know, sort of small in the sense of a wall or barrier that's a seawall around a house or a particular building, or they can be an enormous barrier, like they're trying to build, like they have built in the lagoons outside of Venice, like the Thames barrier on the Thames River. You know, they can be on various scales, and, you know, they can work, and they do work sometimes, and they can be very expensive to build, and they have a lot of ecological and environmental consequences. There's a lot of social justice consequences to wall building, in the sense of who's behind it and who's not. But, you know, so that's one thing. I mean, there's other things that can be done, including elevating buildings, improving drainage. You know, these are sort of more short-term kinds of things. But ultimately, you know, what we're talking about is a retreat from the shorelines. I mean, the economics of this are so daunting for any kind of adaptation. And there is going to be adaptation in certain places, but there's also going to be a massive retreat, because we're not going to be able to afford to kind of protect our cities and protect these places and just sort of go on about our business and think we're going to put up a wall and everything's going to be fine. What our future looks like is, you know, massive retreat from coastlines, so whatever the technological response is.
Oh, Right. That's worth reflecting upon. Now, you is it called Eco Atlantic? How do you pronounce that in Lagos?
Yeah, Eco Atlantic, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was quite an intriguing project. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Lagos was one of my favorite places, or not favorite, most eye-opening trips I took in reporting this book, for two reasons. One is I spent a couple of weeks living in the water slums in the lagoon in Lagos, where several hundred thousand people live, essentially squatters in these lagoons. And they live on these houses, shacks, you know, built out of scraps on poles in the water. And one of the things that I really understood there that is not so profound, but it's profound when you really think about it, is that, you know, our problems with sea level rise really are about, you know, inflexible infrastructure. Because when I was there in the slums in Lagos, you know, I talked to them about sea level rise, and they were like, or storm surges and stuff. And, you know, basically they just shrugged and they said, you know, we need to raise our houses 4 feet. We can do that in, you know, 2 days. You know, that's not a problem. You know, we commute by boats anyway. And it's like, no big deal. We got other things to worry about, you know, and it's true. I mean, they didn't build, you know, $1 million condos, you know, right on the beach thinking that, you know, they were going to, that beach was always going to be there. And so the sort of simpleness of their structures and everything, you know, has a big impact on their vulnerability. And I think a lot of the sort of future architecture that I've been looking at and people that I've been talking to, you know, are thinking about exactly those kinds of things, about how do you build in a flexible way on and around water. So that was one thing. The second thing was Eco Atlantic, which you pointed out is a massive development on the coast of Lagos, where they basically built a, you know, filled in a part of the coastline and built this sort of enormous, well, it's about 3 miles long and a mile and a half wide, this, you know, this sort of appendage to the city, which is going to be a fortress for middle class and wealthy Nigerians and others who want to live in Nigeria. It's you know, they want to turn it into what they call the Dubai of Africa. And, you know, it's you know, may or may not make any sense economically. And they're having trouble kind of finishing it because of financing after the financial crisis and everything. But, you know, it's surrounded by 25-foot walls, basically, of, you know, rock. And you know, they're selling it as this sort of fortress of protection. And what's so striking about it is that it really is the sort of, you know, archetype of the social divide that sea level rise and climate change more broadly brings to a lot of cities, which is, you know, okay, so you're living on this, you know, eco-Atlantic fake island, and you're safe, and you're 25 feet above the sea, and you don't have to worry about sea level rise and all that. But, you know, you're surrounded by, you know, 19 million people who are living, you know, at water level and in slums. And, you know, how safe and protected are you really when you're in your fortress on the coast and everybody else is around you is not. And it was just a very stark example of something that we're going to see playing out, I think, more and more, which is the very sharp line between the sort of saved and the doomed as climate change accelerates.
Yeah. Now, there's tremendous momentum at the moment around cities, really, in terms of dealing with climate change, and you know, notwithstanding the current U.S. government, but generally, did you find any cities that had really thought through some of the implications of?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, New York City, for example, is thinking really hard about a lot of this. You know, they were, you know, had a little shock therapy with Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, that caused a lot of serious thinking about what's going to happen there. And, you know, there was the competition called Rebuild by Design that was basically led and organized by a Dutchman named Henk Ovink, who really, you know, oversaw this process. They came up with a lot of really inspired kind of ways of rethinking how we live along the coast. And, you know, there was $100 million or so of funding from the U.S. government for some of these projects. And a number of them, there were six of them chosen in this design competition, and a number of them are in the process of being built right now. So that was a really interesting example of innovative thinking. And you know, in the mayor's office, the people who are running the kind of climate resilience office are really smart and, you know, trying to change zoning and do various things to force, you know, buildings to move their critical infrastructure to higher floors so they're not vulnerable for flooding and all that. So New York is one place that, you know, has a lot of smart thinking going on. But, you know, like in many places, that smart thinking is dwarfed by the scale of the problems. I mean, New York has enormous problems with, you know, brownstone buildings, you know, built too close to the water with basements and things like that that are very difficult to elevate or protect. You have a subway system that is very vulnerable to flooding, you know, the tunnels between New York and New Jersey. And another big problem that many coastal cities have in New York, Miami, and many Boston, many, many others, is airports, which are often built on landfill right on the water because that was this easy, convenient place to build them. You know, the airports in New York are very vulnerable also. And so eventually there's going to have to be conversations about moving airports and things like that. And that's a very difficult conversation to have.
Right, absolutely. Now, you also mentioned in the book that military bases are at risk and so forth. And this is something I think I noted before, that notwithstanding what the US government says about climate change, it does seem like the military takes it a little bit more seriously.
Yeah, so I spent a good amount of time at Naval Station Norfolk in Norfolk, Virginia, which is the largest Navy base in the world. Headquarters for all of U.S. operations in the Middle East and Europe and all that. It's home to like six aircraft carriers, and, you know, 75,000 people work on this base. It's just this enormous military complex. And I happened to be there with then Secretary of State John Kerry, who understood the risks of sea level rise and climate change very well. And we were on the deck of the USS San Antonio, a battleship, for a anniversary of the Marine Corps. And he asked the commander of the base right in front of me how much time this base has before it's, you know, has to be shut down or moved because of sea level rise. And the base commander said, you know, 20 to 50 years. And, you know, it was a stunning thing to hear. The base commander, you know, telling the Secretary of State that this enormous military complex is going to have to be shut down or moved in as little as 20 years. And it's emblematic of, you know, the challenges that the military faces, because, you know, the military has a lot of money that they can spend on all kinds of things, including adapting to sea level rise. But the problem is that, you know, they can build walls and raise the piers and everything on the military base, but, you know, it doesn't help if the railroads that lead to the base are all underwater. If the roads that lead to the base are all underwater, people can't get to work, they can't get the materials there. So it's not enough to just sort of rebuild and save the base. They have to sort of save the entire area, which is, you know, the entire region. And that's a whole other question, you know. But I was very impressed with the people in the Navy and other military branches that I talked with, because, you know, they have a very practical minded view about this here in the U.S. I mean, you know, as one Navy officer said to me, you know, we deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. And that feeling was very powerful in all my reporting. The problem is that they can't talk publicly about it because, you know, that we have these climate deniers in Congress who will essentially zero out their budget on anything that they talk about that has any connection with climate change. So they have to do things sort of, you know, secretly or quietly, or pretend they're doing them for other reasons in order to you know, take the actions that they know that they need to do.
Yeah, it's terrifying, the climate denial, which seems to be very embedded. Now, some of these, for I guess the developed world, or you can think cities like London or New York, and you can somehow maybe get your head around some of the issues in terms of, you know, moving and so forth, you know, massive as they are. But when you think of places like, you know, Shanghai or Bangladesh, particularly the poorer cities with, you know, massive slums and, you know, very poor infrastructure and things like that, the human tragedy, the scale of the potential human tragedy is just remarkable. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you see that unfolding? Already we've had, you know, all kinds of refugee problems, but, you know, the scale of this is just eye-opening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this is going to be above everything else a kind of humanitarian crisis. You know, it's going to make our refugee crisis now look like, you know, a sort of just a small time thing. The number of people that you know, there's 145 million people around the world who live within 3 feet of the coasts, of the waterline on the coast. I mean, and, you know, there's a lot of the UN and others have tried to do studies about the number of refugees that might be created at various sea level rises. And they're kind of all over the map. But anyone thinking about this for 2 seconds can see that the number of people who will be displaced is huge. You know, one study I was just reading was talking about 12 million people just pushed out of just Florida. And that's not, you know, that's a, you know, wealthy area comparatively. So this is going to be massive, massive rearrangement of humans on the planet here. And, you know, it's obviously places like Bangladesh and the whole west coast of Africa are very vulnerable. But, you know, also the island states are really, you know, they're, for them, the Marshall Islands, for example, where I went, you know, for them, it's not just a, you know, a kind of real estate crisis or an economic crisis. It's like a total existential crisis for them. I mean, their nation, you know, will go underwater unless they, you know, do something. In the Maldives, they're adding land, basically doing some man-made islands to try to kind of compensate for sea level rise. But in the Marshalls, they don't have the money for that. So these nations are thinking, you know, their whole country is going to go underwater. And where are they going to go? And what does it mean for their nation to just cease to exist? What does it mean in a prosaic way for, you know, their fishing rights? They have millions of square kilometers of fishing rights. What happens to those if their nation doesn't exist? Can they, is there, a, you know, do they become a virtual nation of fisher people? I mean, where do they go? You know, are they, you know, Australia is not exactly welcoming to refugees. And, you know, there's all of this sort of, thinking that's beginning to happen as the reality of this displacement begins to kind of seep in.
Yes, yes. How did this leave you at the end? You're not unfamiliar with, you know, coal industry, environmental crisis of various kinds. How did you feel at the end of this? Have you bought a house up in the mountains? And just, you know, are you reasonably optimistic that you know that we'll find a way through this? I mean, it's a massive and distributed problem in many different parts, and clearly some areas will do better than others. And you know, and it all, a lot depends really still on you know, whether it's 1.5 or 2 degrees and over what time frame. And you know, and I know you've also looked at geoengineering, which is, you know, always never very far away these days in people's minds, policymakers at least, and things. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about that just to finally there.
Yeah, well, so my previous book was about geoengineering. It was a book called How to Cool the Planet. And I spent a lot of time with geoengineers and people who were thinking about this. And I think I wrote the book in 2011, I think. And by at that time, you know, geoengineering was, you know, this sort of, you know, dirty little secret that nobody wanted to talk about, that, you know, a few kind of renegade scientists and, you know, political thinkers, you know, were toying with. And I thought it was an interesting, you know, it brought up a lot of really interesting issues and technological, political, all kinds of things. And so I wrote a book about that. But I'm struck by how much it's moved to sort of mainstream kind of discussion about what we're going to do about, you know, the implications of climate change here. And, you know, I mean, I'm not pro geoengineering. I'm not an advocate of it. But I do think that there's a certain inevitability that we'll start trying some of this stuff, especially the particles in the stratosphere to reflect away a little bit of sunlight. And, you know, there's it's no replacement for cutting emissions. But, you know, I do think that, you know, if it's done responsibly and if we kind of allow good scientists to get involved and we really do a good job of understanding better what the implications of it is, it's not necessarily the sort of disaster scenario that a lot of environmentalists would like to paint it to be. But, you know, it's not going to save us, and it could take the edge off of things. And more broadly, you know, sea level rise is going to happen. My book is not called, you know, The Water Will Come Unless We All Put Solar Panels on Our Roofs. You know, it's going to happen because of the amount of heat that's built up in the world's oceans already, because of the long residency of CO2 in the atmosphere. No matter what our emissions scenario looks like, we're going to have significant amount of sea level rise. So, you know, how do I feel about that? I think that, you know, part of the reporting this book, you know, there was parts of it that were very inspiring, and especially speaking with urban planners and architects and others. I mean, when you look at it through the lens of sea level rise, you see how dumb much of the way we've built cities, you know, is. And as you pointed out, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in cities right now. And people are thinking really hard about how to reinvent cities and how to reinvent how we live in urban areas. And sea level rise is part of that. And so I've seen a lot of really interesting work, a lot of interesting experiments and different ways of living with water, different ways of adapting cities, you know, whether it's, you know, floating structures or canals or all kinds of things. So I think there's going to be a lot of really interesting creative stuff that's going to arise out of this moment. But there's the problem is there's also going to be a tremendous amount of suffering and economic devastation, not to mention environmental devastation, ecosystems and things that are going to be lost, you know, as this water comes up. You know, one of the things that I really tried to underscore with the book is the importance, I think, of sort of making these risks transparent to people. There's a lot of people in the world who live on coastlines in ways that have no idea that, you know, that this is real, that this is happening, and that, you know, the value of their real estate, essentially, or their property is hugely at risk. And I think people can choose to live however they want to live, but I really think that this, how to make this risk transparent so people can begin to make choices about, okay, I'm going to leave, I'm selling my place, time for me to get out of here, and I'm going to go somewhere else before, you know, I lose all the value of my property, or before I'm at risk, or whatever. So I really hope that people begin to think differently about their relationship with the coasts.
Absolutely, absolutely. What's next for you now, Jeff? Rest, you're traveling around, talking about your book, and the other projects on the horizon?
Well, I'm going to Australia and New Zealand for writers' festivals and book tours in the next month, or, you know, in the next few weeks. So that's the near term. I'm writing about the rebuilding of Puerto Rico after the storm, because I think that's after the hurricanes, because I think that's a very interesting exercise in, you know, how do you rebuild a place better than before, and what are the politics of that, and the way that, you know, the best ideas, engineering ideas and technological ideas, solar panels, microgrids, all that kind of things, can get derailed by kind of boneheaded and corrupt politics is really interesting. And beyond that, I have a couple of book ideas for my next book, but nothing that I'm 100% committed to yet.
Right. Well, I wish you the very best of success, Jeff. And thank you so much for talking to us today and sharing your insights and all the work that you've done on The Water Will Come.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.